Welcome, and thank you for joining us next to the campfire here. We appreciate you showing an interest in the Squatch Stories. And to get this week's episode kicked off, we're going to go ahead and introduce the short story. So grab your favorite blanket, curl up next to the campfire, and get ready to listen to A Night in the Castle.
April 29th, 1893. My dearest beloved, I am greatly anticipating my arrival in Chicago. Taking this opportunity to visit the World's Columbian Exposition will reap, I hope, massive beneficial rewards. The knowledge I hope to gain from many of the exhibits here, I should be able to return to our small town and help push our little community into a new era. I have heard many rumors on the train about the experts and the professionals that are supposed to attend and lecture at the exposition. And I mustn't lie. My being is overflowing with joy that I should ascertain the keys to our future and that of our hometown and those that we love. I shall write to you every day, and if I time these out just right, my last letter should arrive to you just mere hours before I love John. April 30th, 1893. My dearest beloved, in the process of getting myself acclimated to Chicago, the first thing I needed to accomplish was acquiring a boarding. Alas, my pursuit had been halted in many different avenues. But I finally came across this quaint hotel. Desperate, I requested with the innkeep about their availability on rooms. She was much gracious on offering a room at a steal of a price. In my desperation, and in her generosity, I had paid for my whole stay up front to assure myself I wouldn't have to worry about board for the duration of my trip. I can only hope that the rest of my trip will be as, dare I say, lucky. Love, John. May 1st, 1893. My dearest beloved, the first day of the exposition has been glorious. The amount of lectures and men of science here is a daunting experience due to massive amount of knowledge and wisdom. New agriculture techniques, railways expanding on steam power, a moving walkway. My God! If I cannot bring just a drop of this knowledge back home, then this trip is an utter failure. But luckily enough, you know as well as I, my mind is like a sponge, soaking all the knowledge that it can. I cannot wait to see what this brings. Love, John. May 2nd, 1893. My dearest beloved, I am quite concerned with my accommodations. On the first night of my stay, I thought I heard some rustlings in the room adjacent. I, of course, ignored it, for it only lasting just a second. But the oddest thing had happened. For the last two nights, I had seen that the rooms on either side of me were both occupied at night. But on my departure this morning, the rooms both looked vacant. Wouldn't usually be a concern to me, except I heard some rustling last night, lasting much longer than a few mere seconds. And the night before last, I could have sworn I heard a woman screaming down the hall. Normally, I would just find accommodations elsewhere. But seeing as I had spent half of my board finances for the full duration of my trip here, I don't think accommodations elsewhere would be feasible at this time. Apologies, my love. I had to pull away for a moment. A very questionable man she's my love. I had to pull away for a moment. A very questionable-looking man was at my door. He looked as though he was trying to peer through the keyhole once I was opening the door. Maybe I should try to find another place to stay. I will be home as soon as I can. Love, John.
Man, is it just me or does that guy sound a little familiar?
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good, you?
You know, losing my mind, but that's normal.
Like half of America?
Yeah. Speaking of, hi! How are you? I know you're listening. Or at least I hope you're listening. Are you listening right now? We're listening to you.
And those crickets.
Yeah, those crickets. The only time that it's been a good time to actually have those crickets there. Hi, everybody. We missed you.
Hopefully you missed us.
Yes, hopefully the feeling's mutual. If you haven't seen the video on Facebook, there is a video that we're doing something new, something different, for Facebook land. We're sorry. We sent out an apology video. We sent out an apology podcast. It's been a minute. And I know at this time, especially at this time, with everything that's going on in the world, not just America, but the world, this global pandemic that's going on, everybody's out there scouring for content in their quarantine to keep themselves preoccupied. And we fell short on providing you with the content. I was kind of hoping that we would be able to, you know, post regularly and everything else. But turns out that Constance and I are both essential workers.
Who would have guessed?
Who in their right mind would have ever guessed that? We don't know. Now, we are not the heroes of the day. We are not the ones on the front line sitting. Well, you kind of are.
Kinda. Just because I see and deal with people during the day.
What I'm saying is that we're not the doctors and nurses trying to help with this pandemic.
Not by any means.
I'm making sure that bacon is hitting your shelves in your stores. And Constance is handing out your Big Macs. That's our day jobs, guys. It's depressing.
So stop looking at me funny because you're coming through my drive-thru.
Yeah. What?
You wouldn't believe how many people would look at us funny because they're in our drive-thru.
Mm-hmm.
And like they wonder why we're not shut down.
Well, yeah.
And all we could think of is because of you people who want to come through our drive-thru.
Exactly.
Is the reason why we're still open.
See, but I'm kind of hoping that's just a regional mentality. It could be the same mentality elsewhere, but, you know, we're trying to provide a food service for you guys, one form or another. I'm just a factory worker providing on a large scale. Constance is providing to a regional scale, but, yeah, we've kind of fallen short on making the podcast for you guys to help just for 30 minutes to 45 minutes at a time to keep you preoccupied. Keep your minds at not necessarily at ease because of the content that we provide, but, you know, just a distraction. And we're hoping that we've talked it over and we're going to push really hard to try to stay active on a regular basis like we were before all this had happened. Man, we've had a few months here recently. With everything that's been going on in our lives, and then this COVID-19 thing does not help whatsoever. So, we're back. Maybe forever.
We can only hope. It just depends on us now.
Yes, it just depends on us. Anyways, like I was saying, that's something new. I started off with that and I didn't even finish. So on Facebook, on Facebook, if you guys want, we have, if you follow us on Facebook, which I hope you do, every single one of you that's listening, all three of you, if you follow us on Facebook, I'm sure that you've noticed that we've had videos pop up of us. Well, we've had some equipment upgrades and everything like that. And what we're going to start doing is for the short stories, we're going to sit here and record our beautiful, adoring faces as we act out the short stories. And hopefully, you know, with the finished product and everything like that, they somewhat come out decent. I don't know. It's basically just us acting.
Sorry in advance.
Sorry in advance. But, you know, hopefully that gets a little more traffic on the podcast. You know, it's all a marketing scheme, I swear, that I don't know anything about. That's why we rely on you people that listen to us regularly to tell a friend. Say, hey, go listen to these two idiots because they're losing their minds just like everybody else is. But, hey, Constance.
Yes.
That short story.
Yes.
What did you think of it?
It's sweet of him to still be writing letters.
This was back in the 1800s, so I'm kind of hoping he was still writing letters.
Yeah,
it's not like he was hitting a chick up on Snapchat.
Shut up. Sliding
into her DMs going, hey.
You know what? No, the whole time I was listening to that, that's all I could think of.
It's so sweet that he's writing letters. Well, it's so over 100 years ago. So.
Shut up. It sounded better in my head. Okay.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's all right. So did that short story give you an idea of what I've brought to the table today?
Well, I first guessed it was going to be a paranormal, but you told me I'm completely wrong. Nope,
it's
not
a paranormal. It is a true crime story.
Oh, God. Okay.
So,
some horror.
All right. So, like, where's the area? Where are we looking at here? Because I said it in the short story.
Yes, I
that was literally like the third line in the short story. The premise of our story takes place in Chicago.
Okay.
But before we get into the antics that had taken place in Chicago, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our character and a little bit of his early life, okay?
Okay.
Herman Webster Mudgett. Ever heard of him before?
Webster sounds.
He is not the one that helped write Webster's Dictionary.
Damn. Okay. Well, my idea is out of the window. All right.
Herman here was born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, on May 16th, 1861. All right. To two English immigrants, Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price. I don't know the origin of her name, but I fucking love it.
Theodate. Who named these? Oh, God. Okay.
Again, 100 years ago.
I know. Although, you know.
He was the third child in the family of five kids. Older sister Ellen, older brother Arthur, younger brother Henry, and youngest sister Mary. The father, Mr. Levi, was from a farming family, and at times he worked as a farmer and trader, house painter, etc., blah, 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 blah. I don't know why I put this in my notes, but both of his parents were devout Methodist. Oh, that's why. Both parents were devout Methodists. Now, when we actually get into why this guy is famous, or infamous, however, whichever, one of the tactics that the prosecuting team did was try to blame his upbringing, like, oh, daddy beat him when he was drunk and all this other bullshit, he used to kill kittens for fun all the time, you know. None of this was true.
Is this gonna be like a religious kind of bullshit?
No. Don't do that. No, this isn't a religious fanatical deal, but don't call it bullshit.
Okay, my bad.
You apologize.
Sorry, but not sorry.
Well, we can see where she stands on that side of the line. I'm just saying, don't anger the five people that listen to us, okay? Who knows? One of them could be a devout Methodist. Did you ever think of that? Huh? No, I didn't think so.
Sorry, but not sorry.
So, like I was saying, the prosecuting team tried to do that. Well, it all turned out to be a complete hoax. Daddy wasn't a mean drunk, didn't beat him. Mommy didn't beat him upside the head with a Bible every single day. He didn't kill kittens in his younger age, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm slipping away from the history of this guy. So, at the age of 16, Mudgett graduated from high school and took teaching jobs in Gimleton, and then later in nearby Alton. Okay.
Okay.
So this guy was teaching for a little bit. On July 4th, 1878, he married a woman by the name of Clara Lovering in Alton. Okay. Their son, Robert Lovering, Mudgett, was born on February 3rd, 1880, in Loudon, New Hampshire. Okay.
Okay.
So, again, we're just going over the basics here. The little... Mudgett enrolled in the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont at age 18. So, he graduated high school at 16, taught classes...
Was he, like, a genius?
Kinda. So, at 18, he enrolled into the University of Vermont, but was dissatisfied with the school and left after just 1 year. Said, you guys are fucking idiots. I'm outski.
So, like, dunzo. Most
No, most college students go, I'm hungry. I can't afford this anymore. I gotta go work. No, this guy's, you guys are morons. I'm out. So while he was enrolled there at the university. Oh, sorry. I got ahead on my notes here. I actually have notes, everybody. I actually took the time to type out notes. Constance said I was insane. Or sick. One or two. Oh, man. Yours is handwritten. I don't know who can read them.
Maybe
those crickets.
Maybe we should ask one of the dollars.
So, in 1882, he entered the University of Michigan's Department of Medicine and Surgery and graduated in June 1884. So, 2 years... 2 years being in medicine and surgery, he graduates. Where now it's like a fucking seven-year program, plus the continuation, because they come out with new techniques every fucking year. Oh yeah, no, it's ridiculous to be a doctor now. And let's everybody, if you know a doctor or a nurse or anybody in the healthcare career. Send him a thank you. Tell them that there's this goofy guy, this goofy looking dude in Southeast Kansas that says thank you. Personally, I appreciate that. You tell him Squatch says. Elbow five. While he was enrolled there at the University of Michigan, he worked in the anatomy lab under Professor Herdman. Later, Professor Herdman had disappeared. Allegedly.
Okay.
A lot of that comes up later on. It's really weird. Mudgett was apprenticed in New Hampshire under Dr. Naaman White, a noted advocate of human dissection. Ooh, there's one little stepping stone right there. You following? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Housemates, friends of the Mudgetts, you know, Clara and Herman here, housemates described Mudgett as treating Clara violently. And in 1884, before he graduated, she moved back to New Hampshire and later wrote she knew little of him afterwards. Okay. After he moved to Moore's Forks, New York, a rumor spread that Mudgett had been seen with a little boy who later disappeared. Mudgett claimed the boy went back to his home in Massachusetts. No investigation took place, and Mudgett quickly left town.
So we're starting to see some little stepping stones here in his early life that's like, huh, weird. What's going on with this guy? This guy's suspicious. He later traveled to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and got a job as a keeper at Norristown State Hospital, but only quit a few days after. He later took a position at a drugstore in Philadelphia, but while he was working there, a boy died after taking medicine that was purchased at the store while he was on duty. Budget denied any involvement in the child's death and immediately left the city.
Huh?
What?
That doesn't make you look any...
No, that doesn't make you look innocent at all.
Yeah.
So, we've got... an alleged missing professor and two alleged missing kids. Kids, mind you. All right. Right before moving to Chicago, he changed. Oop, no, I don't want to say that part yet. I want to skip that and come back. Put a pin in it. I'm going to put a pin in it. In late 1886, while still married to Clara, Mudgett married a woman by the name of Myrta Belknap. In Minneapolis, Minnesota. This dude's all over the fucking place. He's all over the place. New York, New Hampshire, freaking Chicago, Philadelphia, all over the place, right?
How many wives does he have?
Hold on. We will get there. So, in late 86, while still married to Clara, he met Myrta in Minnesota. He filed for divorce from Clara a few weeks after Mary and Myrta, alleging infidelity on her part.
I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, no. I don't think it works that way either, because I'm just flabbergasted. You cheating hooker. How dare you sleep with somebody else while I'm married to this other woman? Because, you know, we got married right off the bat. No kissing, no hugging, no nothing. That's the only way I could marry her. I couldn't do anything before I married her. Sounds like some South shit going on there. That's my cousin. Did you guys miss us? Did you miss the ramblings of a mad squatch? So, the ramblings of a mad squatch here. Okay. Organize my notes. Blah, 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 blah. Here we go. So, 86 was so weird. Yeah, we dealt with that. Mudgett and Myrta had a little girl, Lucy Theodate Mudgett, who was born on July 4th, 1889, in Inglewood, Chicago, Illinois. Okay. Mudgett lived with Myrta and Lucy in Wilmette, Illinois, and spent most of his time in Chicago tending to business. All right. Yeah. She's doing the air quotes. Later in January of 1894, Mudgett married another woman by the name of Georgiana Yoke in Denver, Colorado, while still married to both Clara and Myrta. Dude's all over the place. All over the place. And that actually kind of ties into the theory at the end of the show. The end of this.
How many wives does he have?
This is three now. So far, only two kids that I found.
Sorry.
Okay.
You didn't get the joke, but.
I didn't get the joke. What's the joke?
It's all I could think of during that whole time, too, is the Tiger King. Doc Atkins. How many wives does he have?
Okay, so hopefully. Hopefully, I like to think that our audience is very intelligent and doesn't succumb to idiotic pop culture.
That we did.
We did. Because we're not intelligent at all. But for a recommendation of something to just literally rot your brain, by all means, go watch the Tiger King series on Netflix. We're from Southeast Kansas, okay? The people portrayed in that Oklahoma show, not all of them are like that. I can swear by it, Testament, but they can keep that shit south of us, all right? They don't need to bring that shit up here.
Sorry, bad joke. Continue. He's on his third wife now.
He's on his third wife, but that's in 1894. So, in late 1886, right before he moved to Chicago with Myrta and little Lucy. So, right before him meeting up with Myrta and having little Lucy and moving to Chicago, Mr. Herman Webster Mudgett had changed his names.
Again?
He no.
Oh.
No, this is the first time he's changed his name. I want you to think about this name, okay? Dr. Henry Howard Holmes. He did this to avoid the possibility of being exposed by victims of his previous scams. Because not only is he suspicious of killing little kids and doing other bad things, he is a notorious con man. Okay?
Is this Mr. Holmes that, like, the detective?
Sherlock?
Sorry, wrong one. Blood moment.
Wow.
Isolation.
So, Holmes had moved to Chicago in 86, in August, okay?
Uh-huh.
He came across Elizabeth S. Holton's drugstore at the southwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in Inglewood. So, after moving to Chicago, he came across Elizabeth S. Holton's drugstore at the southwest corner of South Wallace Avenue and West 63rd Street in Inglewood. Okay. Holton gave Holmes a job and proved to be a hardworking employee, eventually buying the store. He didn't buy the store. Although several books portray Holton's husband as an old man who quickly vanished along with his wife shortly after Holmes had purchased the store.
Of course.
Dun, dun, dun.
Of course.
Dr. Holton was a fellow Michigan alumni, only a few years older than Holmes, and both Holtons remained in Inglewood throughout Mudgett's life and survived well into the 20th century. It is a myth that they were killed by Holmes. Okay. So, just clearing the air on that. But Holmes purchased an empty lot across from the drugstore, where construction began in 1887 for a two-store mixed-use building, with apartments on the second floor and a retail spaces, including a drugstore on the first floor. So not only was he a hardworking man earning his money at the drugstore that this dear old lady and her husband gave him the opportunity to do that, he takes that money, buys the lot across the street, and puts up the exact same kind of business that they're running.
Wouldn't that put him out of the business?
He's a swell guy. No, he'd be putting the other people out of business. Okay. You know how everybody likes something new and shiny? And he could just be offering free morphine samples at the counter. Who knows?
Morphine?
Shut up. JK. JK.
JK. JK.
When Holmes decided to pay the architects or the steel company, when he declined to pay the architects or the steel company or anybody that was involved with building this two-story building, he said no. He told him no. So the company Etna Iron and Steel sued him in 1888. Okay. In 1892, he then added a third floor to the building, telling investors and suppliers he intended to use it as a hotel during the upcoming World's Columbian Exposition. The World's Columbian Exposition turned later on became popular and known as the Chicago World Fair.
Okay.
Okay. Do you know anything about the Chicago World Fair?
No.
Okay, so the Chicago World Fair opened up, and what it was, I think it was like a year-long event, and what they did was countries all over the globe had came to this one spot in Chicago, posted up pavilions and exhibits showing the history and techniques and all this other stuff. A lot of scientific people and, all fields, mm-hmm. you know, agriculture, medicine, and all this other stuff. All these people had congregated here to exhibit new techniques and all this other stuff, new technologies, new, and actually... Fun fact. Okay, this isn't a fun fact. I'm not 100% sure if this is an accurate. I'm pretty sure that the Chicago World Fair was actually where the corn dog was invented. Could be wrong. Most likely am wrong. But types of carnival food and stuff like that were also invented at the World Fair for the World Fair. So it was a big deal. A big deal. So he added the third floor, telling everybody, hey, I'm going to make this a hotel so everybody can stay here when they come to Chicago and bring all this revenue and tourist money and blah, 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 blah. Though the hotel portion was never completed, furniture suppliers found Holmes was hiding their materials for which he had never paid in hidden rooms and passageways throughout the building.
Of course.
So, a little bit about the building. As you hear my clickety-click on the laptop. There were soundproofed rooms and mazes of hallways, some of which seemed to go absolutely nowhere. Many of the rooms were outfitted with chutes in the closet that led straight down to the basement, where Holmes had acid vats. Quick lime and crematorium to dispose of his victims' bodies.
So he planned this from like the get-go.
This is why that the castle in Chicago, Illinois was also known as the Murder Castle. It was a torture home for H.H. Holmes.
I remember seeing a picture of of this.
I can't get into it. This tells you how extensive my note taking really was. I honestly can't remember if the building's still up in Chicago as of right now. I can't remember. I want to say it is, but I could definitely be wrong. Shit, I could be wrong about all this. I just made this up.
I can believe that.
Like all of our stories.
I can believe that.
I'm just really bad at research. Really bad at it. Sorry, everybody. I hope you came here for half-ass information to get you interested and somebody else that's willing to sit down and write 16 fucking books about this one guy.
Or maybe you're interested in just looking up the shit. Even more than what we do.
Yeah, more extensive.
And then you could come and tell us that we're fucking wrong.
So, when the furniture suppliers had searched the hotel, their search made the news. And investors for the planned hotel pulled out of the deal when a jeweler in the building showed them the articles. The hotel was gutted by a fire started by an unknown arsonist shortly after. Holmes was arrested, but was largely... the hotel was gutted by a fire started by an unknown arsonist shortly after Holmes was arrested, but was largely rebuilt and used as a post office until 1938. Okay. So that's just the extended history of what happened to the building itself. In 1892, the hotel was somewhat completed with three stories and a basement. The first floor was the storefront. The second story consisted of these elaborate torture rooms, which contained a chute that led to the basement. The third floor held more apartment rooms. And in 1894... some police officers inspected the hotel while Holmes was out. During this inspection, they found rooms with hinged walls and false partitions. Rooms linked with secret passageways and even airtight rooms that were connected to pipelines filled with gas, which Holmes used as gas chambers. Anyways, so Holmes would use the chutes to deliver the bodies to the basement, and once there, he made use of surgical tables and an array of medical tools to dissect them before selling their organs and their bones on the black market to the medical institutions in the area or around the country.
Does the people know that they're buying, like, human?
Well, here's the thing. Back in the 1800s and before, when in the 1800s, especially the late 1800s, there was a lot of grave exhumations, whatever grave the word digging. Is. Sure, grave digging. A lot of people would go out to cemeteries, dig up graves, and take the bodies to medical institutions, because at this time they were still trying to discover and perfect certain techniques. And it's not like, you know, a school could be like, I don't have any dead bodies. Start making dead bodies for me so they can figure it out. So a lot of these people in the black market would go dig up these graves, take these people like Holmes had done, dissect them, tear out the organs, sell the organs separately, and then sell the skin. Anyway, so that's what used to happen.
Okay.
So it would only make sense for a devious man such as Holmes, and a con man that he was, to partake in doing this. Because you could actually make a lot of money.
I wouldn't doubt it.
So it was, I mean, it was a really shitty time in our history. But you know what? Look at all the advancements that we had in it. Could it have been a better thing? Could there have been a better way? Hell yes. Consent is always the best way to go. But if we didn't have greedy, horrible people in this world, we wouldn't have been able to make the advancements that we did.
True.
As shitty as that sounds, because it is very shitty. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about some of the people that we have proof that it happened. One of his early murder victims that we know of, mm-hmm. that we can equate to this hotel.
Did he confess to him or Okay,
we'll get later into that, but he confessed to 27 murders.
Oh, fuck, okay.
They could only prove 9.
Ew.
So it's one of those things. It's really tough to take the word of a serial killer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyways, one of his earliest victims that we know of that is tied in with the murder castle was his mistress. Dudes all over the country.
Is this making it number 4 or?
No, she's just his mistress. Oh. He's not married to her. Her name was Julia Smythe. She was the wife of Ned Connor, who had moved into Holmes's building and began working at his pharmacy's jewelry counter.
He the one that blew the whistle.
Nah. After Connor had found out about his wife's affair with Holmes, he quit his job and moved away, leaving Smythe and her daughter, Pearl, behind. Smythe gained custody of Pearl and remained at the hotel, continuing her relationship with Holmes. Julia and Pearl both disappeared on Christmas Eve of 1891, and Holmes later claimed she had died during an abortion, though what truly happened to the two was never really confirmed.
That's sad.
He's an evil son of a bitch.
I know.
Another likely Holmes paramour, Emmeline Sigrada. I know I'm pronouncing that wrong. She began working in the building in May of 1892 and disappeared that December. Another woman who'd vanished was Edna Van Tassel, who believed to have been among a lot of his victims. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 right there off the bat within 2 years of this whole
ordeal.
Yeah. And that's not including the two kids that got him moving across Northern America, Northeast America. While working in the chemical bank building on Dearborn Street, Holmes met and became close friends with a Mr. Benjamin Peitzel. Now, this is a very, very critical player in this. Peitzel was a carpenter with a criminal past who was exhibiting in the same building a coal bin that he had invented. Oh, yeah, okay. So that's how they became buddies. Peitzel invented something new. Yeah. Holmes used Peitzel as his go-to guy. He was his right-hand man with several criminal schemes. A district attorney later described Peitzel as Holmes's tool, his creature.
Weird. Okay.
In early 1893, the year of the World Fair, a one-time actress named Minnie Williams, okay, one-time actress, she only had one movie, Holmes claimed to, she moved to Chicago. He claimed to have met her in an employment office, though there were rumors he had met her in Boston years earlier, okay. He offered her a job at the hotel as his personal stenographer. And she accepted. Down on her luck. Actress that wasn't getting paid. So she said, fuck it, I can type. Holmes persuaded Williams to transfer the deed to her property in Fort Worth, Texas, to a man named Alexander Bond. You want to take a guess on who Alexander Bond was?
Who's Alexander?
It was an alias that Mr. Benjamin Peitzel had used. In April of 1893, Williams transferred the deed, with Holmes serving as the notarer. Holmes later signed the deed over to Peitzel, giving him the alias Benton T. Lyman, another alias. The next month, Holmes and Williams, presenting themselves as man and wife, rented an apartment in Chicago's Lincoln Park. Minnie's sister Annie came to visit. And in July, she wrote to her aunt that she planned to accompany brother Harry to Europe. Neither Minnie nor Annie was seen alive after July 5th, 1893.
Damn.
Yeah. So that's another two. What are we up to? Seven now?
Well, if we were... Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, no, six.
Well, plus the two kids, so eight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Holmes had an entrepreneurial spirit. Based on his formal medical education and his connections, he was able to sell skeletons to medical labs and schools. He and sometimes a hired assistant were accused of stripping the flesh off the bodies, dissecting them, preparing the viable skeletons. The rest of the remains would be tossed in pits of lime or acid, effectively breaking down the remaining evidence. Yeah. I could have organized my notes a little bit better. I'm sorry, everybody. We're rusty. I'm rusty. Well, I'm Squatch.
See, okay, so I know there's like a...
There's a joke there, and you're just going to step all over it? The Rusty Squatch? Anyways, what is it that you don't get?
I was just going to say there was like a conspiracy theory.
We will touch base on that before you even bring it up, okay? Because I know what you're going to say.
I'm going to say here.
We will touch base on that. Okay. Quit thinking about it. Listen to the rest of what I got.
Sorry, that's all I can think about right now. Okay, go. All right,
so we're moving on to his capture and arrest, okay?
Okay.
With insurance companies pressing to prosecute Holmes for arson, Holmes left Chicago in July of 1894. He appeared in Fort Worth, weird, where he had inherited property from the Williams sisters, weird, quote unquote, I actually put fingers up in the air and do the air quotes.
Oh God.
On Inherited. The property was located at the intersection of modern day Commerce Street and Second Street. They're in Fort Worth right now. So if you're in Texas and you're listening to us and in Fort Worth, go to this corner and you will stand where this crazy psychopath had once stand. It's eerie, isn't it?
Just those crickets.
But do, 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 do. So on this property in Fort Worth, he wanted to make another castle along the lines of a Chicago operation, once again swindling a number of suppliers. So he had the investors ready to start building this building. In July of 1894, Holmes was arrested and briefly incarcerated for the first time on the charge of selling mortgaged goods in St. Louis, Missouri. He was promptly bailed out, but while in jail, I told you he was all over the country. He's all over the country. So that theory that you're thinking about is a high probability. He was promptly bailed out, but while in jail, he struck up a conversation with a convicted outlaw named Marion Hedgepath, who was serving a 25-year sentence. Holmes had concocted a plan to swindle an insurance company out of $10,000. In 2019 money, that's $296,000. By taking out a policy on himself and then faking his own death.
I could believe that.
Well, back in the times, because you remember the Michael Malloy story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back in those times, it was very easy to get away with the life insurance schemes. Yeah, it wasn't but $2 to get a new Social Security card and everything else. Holmes promised Hedgepath a $500 commission in exchange for the name of a lawyer who could be trusted. Holmes was directed to a young St. Louis attorney named Jephtha Howe. Howe was in practice with his older brother, Alfonso Howe, who had no involvement with Holmes or Peitzel or their fraudulent activities. Jephtha, however, found Holmes's scheme brilliant. Nevertheless, Holmes' plans to fake his own death failed when the insurance company became suspicious and refused to pay. Holmes didn't press the claim. Instead, he concocted a similar plan with Peitzel.
Of course.
Again, I told you Peitzel was going to become a key player in this.
He's going to die?
Now, dang it, why do you always got to jump ahead of me on this?
I'm sorry.
So, Holmes talked to Peitzel and said, hey, why don't you fake your own death? Peitzel agreed to it. And they said, okay, we'll do this, and my wife could collect on the $10,000 life insurance policy while she was to split it with Holmes and Jephtha Howe. Okay? The scheme, which was to take place back in Philadelphia, called for Peitzel to set himself up as an inventor under the name of B.F. Perry and then be killed and disfigured in a lab explosion. Yeah.
Okay.
So as they're getting this set up, Holmes was to find an appropriate cadaver to play the role of Peitzel. Instead, Holmes killed Peitzel. The scheme, which was to take place in Philadelphia, called for Peitzel to set himself up as an inventor under the name B.F. Perry and then be killed and disfigured in a lab explosion. Kinky. Holmes was to find an appropriate cadaver to play the role of Peitzel. Instead, he killed him by knocking him unconscious with chloroform and setting his body on fire with the use of benzene.
Okay.
So, in his confession, Holmes implied Peitzel was still alive after he used the chloroform on him prior to being set on fire. However, forensic evidence presented that Holmes' later trial showed chloroform had been administered after Peitzel's death. a fact which the insurance company was unaware of. So, presumably to fake suicide to exonerate Holmes's, should he be charged with murder. Okay, you see what I'm saying there?
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to make sure, because it sounded weird. But anyway, so Holmes put the chloroform on Peitzel after the death. That way they could go back, look at the autopsy, and be like, oh no, he's got chloroform all in his system. He set himself on fire and then chloroformed himself, you know, to not feel the pain. It makes sense in his mind, and I'm a little terrified that I was able to put the dots together so easily. Holmes collected the insurance payout on the basis of the genuine Peitzel corpse. Holmes then went to manipulate Peitzel's unsuspecting wife into allowing three of her five children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, to be in his custody.
What?
Yep. The eldest daughter and the baby remained with Mrs. Peitzel. Holmes and the three Peitzel children travels throughout the northern United States and into Canada. Simultaneously, he escorted Mrs. Peitzel along a parallel route. So he was having the kids travel on this train. He had her travel on this train. Still coordinating all this stuff to stay together-ish. All the while using various aliases and lying to Mrs. Peitzel concerning her husband's death. Deeming Peitzel was hiding in London. Claiming Peitzel was hiding in London. Slow down. As well as lying to her about the true whereabouts of her three missing children. In Detroit, just prior to entering Canada, they were only separated by just a few blocks. And in even more audacious move, Holmes was staying at another location with his wife, who was unaware of the whole thing. Had no clue. Holmes would later confess to murdering Alice and Neely by forcing them into a large trunk and locking them inside. He drilled a hole in the lid of the trunk and put one end of a hose through the hole, attaching the other end to a gas line to asphyxiate the girls. Holmes buried their nude bodies in the cellar of his rental house at 16th Street, St. Vincent Street in Toronto.
What?
Yep. Yeah, he killed the two girls.
What?
So in walks in a police detective by the name of Frank Geyer, okay? A Philadelphia police detective assigned to investigate Holmes and find the three missing children. He found the decomposed bodies of the two Peitzel girls in the cellar of the Toronto home. Geyer wrote, the deeper we dug, the more horrible the odor became. And when we reached the depth of 3 feet, we discovered what appeared to be the bone of a forearm of a human being. Geyer then went to Indianapolis, where Holmes had rented a cottage. Holmes was reported to have visited a local pharmacy to purchase the drugs which he used to kill Howard, the boy, and a repair shop to sharpen the knives he used to chop up the body before he burned it. The only way that they figured this is what had happened, the boy's teeth and bits of bone were discovered in the home's chimney at the cottage. Holmes's murder spree finally ended when he was arrested in Boston on November 17th, 1894. After being tracked there from Philadelphia by the Pinkertons, he was held on an outstanding warrant for horse theft in Texas. Horse theft in Texas. This man had killed countless children and women and his partner in crime, and they get him in jail for stealing a fucking horse.
Don't mess with the Texans'
horse. That's all I gotta say, everybody. As the authorities had become more suspicious at this point, and Holmes appeared poised to flee the country in the company of his unexpected third wife. Following the discovery of Alice and Neely's bodies in July of 1895, Chicago police and reporters began investigating Holmes's building in Inglewood, now locally referred to as the Castle. Though many sensational claims were made, no evidence was found which could have convicted Holmes in Chicago. According to Seltzer stories, of torture equipment found in the building are 20th century fiction. This is an author that was writing on Holmes that stated that. In October of 1895, Holmes was put on trial for the murder of Benjamin Peitzel and was found guilty and sentenced to death. By then, it was evident Holmes had also murdered the Peitzel children. Following his conviction, Holmes confessed to 27 murders in Chicago, Indianapolis, and Toronto, though some persons he confessed to murdering were still alive. That's why I said back with the Holtons, the owners of the drugstore, the original drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those were two that he had claimed. So on top of the 27 murders he confessed to, he also confessed to 6 attempted murders. Holmes was paid $7,500 in 2019 money. That was $230,000 by the Harris newspapers in exchange for his confession, which was quickly found to be mostly nonsense.
Yeah.
He gave various contradicting accounts on his life, initially claiming innocence, and later he was possessed by Satan. While writing his confessions in prison, Holmes mentioned how drastically his facial appearance had changed since his imprisonment. He described his new grim appearance as gruesome and taking on satanical cast, and wrote he was now convinced that after everything that he had done, was beginning to resemble the devil. Holmes also was found quoted, "I was born with a devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. I was born with the evil one, standing as my sponsor beside the bed while I was unsheared into the world, and he has been with me ever since." On May 7th, 1896, Holmes was hanged at the Moyamensing Prison, also known as the Philadelphia County Prison, for the murder of Peitzel. Until the moment of his death, Holmes remained calm and collected, showing very few signs of fear, anxiety, or depression. Despite this, he asked for his coffin to be contained in cement and buried 10 feet deep because he was concerned grave robbers would steal his body and use it for dissection.
It would serve him right.
Yeah, right? Holmes's neck, when hung, did not snap. He instead strangled to death and slowly, twitching for over 15 minutes before being pronounced dead 20 minutes after the trap had sprung. I mean, couldn't have happened to a better guy.
Serves him right.
On March 7th, 1914, the Chicago Tribune reported that with the death of Quindon, who was a former caretaker of the castle, the mysteries of Holmes's castle would remain unexplained. Quinton had died by suicide by taking strychnine. His body was found in his bedroom with a note that read, "I couldn't sleep." Quinton's surviving relatives claimed that he had been haunted for several months and was suffering from hallucinations. The castle itself was mysteriously gutted by a fire in August of 1895. According to a newspaper clipping from the New York Times. Two men were seen going into the back of the building around 8 and 9 at night. About a half hour later, they were seen exiting the building and rapidly running away. Following several explosions, the castle went up in flames. So, hey, I don't think it's there anymore. Investigators found a half-empty gas can underneath the back steps of the building. The building survived the fire. Oh, hey, it did. And remained in use until it was torn down in 1938.
So, no, it's not.
No, it's not. Son of a gun. The site is occupied by the Inglewood branch of the United States Post Office. Now, to what you kept interrupting me about earlier and kept you kept trying to drag it out and drag it out and drag it out, and you're just being impatient. Impatient.
I'm sorry.
Okay. So, due to what you were so sly about trying to persuade to, the theory.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So here's the deal. In 2017, amid allegations Holmes had in fact escaped execution, Holmes' body was exhumed for testing led by Janet Monge of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Due to his coffin being contained in cement, his body was found not to have decomposed normally. His clothes were almost perfectly preserved, and his mustache was found to be intact. The body was positively identified as being that of Holmes with his teeth, and then he was reburied. Now, later, I'm not 100% sure. I know they released a documentary of it last year, back in 2019, that his great-grandson had shed some light on one of the most notorious theories about H.H. Holmes. That being that H.H. Holmes was actually one the only Jack the Ripper. Now, as we've gone over the history of Holmes in a very light involvement here, the time frame of the Jack the Ripper killings and H.H. Holmes killings were roughly around the same timeline. Now, H.H. Holmes, he got around a lot and easily. He didn't have any issues moving across this country,
obviously,
moving into Canada. So, for the theory, it is very plausible. I would actually say that there could be some girth to it. Now, I haven't gone into the documentary. I'm not 100% sure what the outcome was. I'm pretty sure the outcome was negative. He wasn't Jack the Ripper. But there is a really good docuseries that they just released. And I, for the god of me, I can't remember what it was called. But anyways, it all stems from the great-great-grandson, or the great-grandson of Mudgett, Holmes, that he said that his grandpa was Jack the Ripper, and they actually went into an it's a very nice investigative documentary by what I hear, that they dig deep into trying to follow his path all right. The way, you know. And I mean, when your grandkid's sitting there saying, no, I think this guy's the real fucking thing. But you know, I digress from that. With that being said and everything, this concludes my little story about America's first notorious serial killer, Howard Henry Holmes. So what do you think?
Yup.
I just spent 45 minutes going over this with you, 30 minutes, however fucking long it's been, and that's all I get is
yep. They're all fucked up.
What do you mean?
the mindset of these serial killers.
Well, I mean, that's what makes them serial killers. Is
They're all fucked up. I mean, yep.
So, okay, well, here's my question. If he wasn't tied to murders, then he was just a con man, what would you say then?
He must be a really good con man. Wow. Like, what are you looking for here?
Yeah, I don't know. Some little banter, something. If you got nothing, we'll just go ahead and wrap this up, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, it's the same for...
Usually you chime in with something towards the end here, but...
Normally, but on this one, I don't...
It is what it is.
It's I don't okay. have anything.
We just suck at our jobs, that's all.
We do. I can't wait for mine.
Right. So anyways, everybody, we're back. Hopefully... I shed some light on this story for you. If not, just go ahead and yell at me. It's okay. I appreciate it. I want constructive criticism. But again, we're back. And as soon as I get all this edited and everything posted, oh God, all this other late work that I gotta do. Everything that I gotta do. Anyways, to wrap this up, thanks guys for listening. We really appreciate it. And we're hoping that you and yours are doing well and keeping safe in this time of panic, turmoil, whatever you want to say. Stay safe. Stay 6 feet apart. And hopefully we can keep bringing content to you guys at an actual regular basis instead of this sporadic thing that we've been going through. Don't forget to check out the video on YouTube. On YouTube. No, we're not on YouTube. Check out the video on Facebook. And just remember, you know, like and share with everybody. And we love you. Oh, and don't forget, hit us up on anchor.fm and go ahead and leave your personal stories, your ghost stories, your hopefully not true crime stories. I don't want to hear about you stabbing somebody. Please don't send that stuff to us, okay? Or if you're an accessory to murder or whatever. I don't want to know about that at all. Please don't tell us about that. But you can tell us about the spooky stuff. Or maybe your third degree from Kevin Bacon story. I don't know. Hit us up on anchor.fm and leave us a voice message, even if it is just to say hi. Or find us on Facebook and hit us up there and say hi. We really want to hear from you guys. We want to make sure that you guys are still there. Because we're still here. Barely, but we're still here. And we'd love to hear from you guys and make sure that everybody's doing all right. So, we love you.
Catch you later.
Catch you later. That's what you get.
Sorry, bit rusty.
Yeah, I know. All right, guys. We'll catch you next time.